Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-hosts, teacher and socialist Andy Lipson, and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda. We are online at what-s-left.webnode.com. A quick reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe. Today we will be discussing the passing of the USA Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Andy Lipson's favorite justice, Supreme Court justice.
True.
It's just that I know how much you love her, so, and how much praise you're going to give her throughout this entire thing. So, back to the seriousness. Maybe I'll start off with some background information, just so that we can give folks an idea of who or why RBG was so significant to, especially the Democrats. So, the Supreme Court announced last Friday that the Justice Ginsburg passed at age 87, and she passed away at her home in Washington, D.C., surrounded by family after succumbing to complications from pancreatic cancer. She served on the Supreme Court for 27 years. She was just the second woman to join the court after she was appointed by Bill Clinton in 1993, and she was the most prominent member of the court's liberal wing, a strong supporter of reproductive rights, women's rights, expanding the gender and sexual diversity community rights, and preserving President Obama's Affordable Care Act. Ginsburg gained fame in the 1970s when she co-founded the Women's Rights Project at the American Civil Liberties Union, where she argued six gender discrimination cases before the Supreme Court. And most recently, Ginsburg's public profile just soared, especially since the court sort of swerved to the right. So what does her death mean? It gives Donald Trump a chance to name a third right-wing justice to the bench. And her death came at just 46 days before the November election, which set off a battle between Democrats and Republicans over fears of Roe versus Wade and other liberal issues. And Senator Majority Leader, which is Mitch McConnell, vowed to hold a vote on the new justice, like literally 5 minutes after her death. And even though he refused to hold so for a confirmation hearing in 2016 for President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, after Justice Antonin Scalia passed away. So that's that. Anyone want to start off first? I mean, this is a 6-3 advantage that Republicans will have in the Supreme Court. And that means a lot to some people. But I could tell some people who I'm looking at, two socialists here, probably don't think it's enough. It doesn't matter.
Kenny, do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the first thought is that here we are again in a similar situation where Supreme Court Justice dies prior to an election, and so it becomes about defeating the evil side on the other side. But I think it's important to backtrack a little bit to when Scalia died under Obama, right? Mm-hmm. After the end of his terms, second term. Supposedly the story is about the Republicans blocking the Democratic nomination of a Supreme Court justice. But in reality, I mean, there's two factors there. There's also the factor that the Democrats didn't want to fight. They wanted to hold that pick as a carrot for its base, for the liberal base. You know, we need to win because this is important for the election. You know, we need to defeat the Republicans. And so that was a calculated, move on their part that obviously you see what happened. The notion that they care about, values and stuff, I think it's, and I'm talking about, the Democratic, party, the leaders who made this calculated decision to not fight, to not push. And so, yeah, I mean, and at the end of the day, to me, yeah, to some degree, it doesn't matter. You know, we have to fight back. If we don't agree with their rulings, we'll have to, you know, raise hell in the streets. But yeah, those are my first thoughts, that it's about politics, it's about the elections. The Democrats are going to use this time around again. I actually don't even see that them pushing hard to have someone. I mean, they will, to the degree that it gets people to the ballot box, you know, from the liberal side, the Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not really even, when I laugh, it's not about a death. Although when Antonio or Anton Scalia, what's his first name?
I looked it up just before because I thought it was Antonio, but it's Antonin.
When Justice Scalia died, there were people who were cheering and things like that because a troglodyte within a judicial monarchy died, right? These are permanent appointments. They're like kings and queens of the justices, right? So when he died, there was no one mourning, nor should that be mourned. There's another member who just of that same monarchy who just went down. I don't mourn that. Like, this is part. These are people, a part of an elite apparatus. I don't think you could say there's more of something that's used to justify and maintain capitalist order. That's more that exposes itself as more undemocratic, as more autocratic, as more just there for the oligarchy, as the Supreme Court, as an institution. And here, my current political scientist from my alma mater, Washington University, did a recent study. And basically, they found, he was looking at what was called a business favorability index for the justices. And he said that the four Democratic appointees, Ginsburg being one of them, also Sotomayor as well, serving on the Roberts Court, that is the court where Roberts was the head guy of that head monarchy, are far more business friendly than Democratic appointees of any other court era, the researcher writes. Even more surprising, the Democrats vote in favor of business at significantly higher rates than Republican appointees in all the other Chief Justice periods, meaning in the pre-Roberts era, these Democrats vote more, and Ginsburg being one of them, vote more pro-business than previous Republican appointees in the earlier than Roberts era. Okay, and of course we could talk about how she justified the Muslim ban and she voted for, or she was in favor of that. She was in favor of the attack on immigrants and restricting asylum seekers and things like that and sending some of them back. She was in favor of Atlantic Coast Pipeline, as well as was part of a 9-0 decision in maybe about 10 years ago, in which two black men were shot, gunned down by police officers. The daughter of one of them tried to sue, and the lower court said, yeah, you can sue. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't sue because these police officers have qualified immunity. Okay, so this is the order that she is part of, okay, and that she supports. And in fact, when people have said, maybe we should limit Supreme Court justices to term limits, she says no, and she's a good friend with former Justice Scalia, and she's known to defend that institution. So again, she's a defender of capitalist judicial monarchy, who's there forever, all right? And she wants that, and she wants to preserve that power. She's going to say she's going to do some good things, and in the past she did. But I don't lose any sleep, and I don't shed any tears for the passing of such a person, because again, she was part of the women's rights movement, as best I know, and there was work she did do, but essentially, she's really a benefactor, a person who benefited from it, and that movement is now gone, and what it's left with is representation by people like Ginsburg that she's saying she speaks in the name of, and I don't think she does. I think she speaks for the capitalists and for the Supreme Court and for maintaining the current system. And I guess the biggest outcome of all this is actually that the Democrats had a record-breaking fundraising. They raised $91 million in 28 hours. So that's the story here. That one section of the capitalist class is going to try to use her death to try to win a ruler ruling over us over another section of the capitalist class. And that's what's at a fight here. And liberals are going nuts, thinking that Ruth Bader, RBG is somehow some sort of a martyr or saint for our cause. And she's not. She is basically a person who oversees our rule using the Supreme Court as a place for doing that, and or rule over us using the Supreme Court. So I don't mourn her loss. And I guess I want to remind people, I don't see her as fundamentally different than a person like Scalia. She might make decisions differently on questions of abortion or women's representation in areas. And I would agree with some of them. In some of them, it's just like, she wants women to be in places of like, I want to make sure that women are in the military so they can go out and kill and destroy and drone just like every other man in this country. And they can torture like they did in Abu Ghraib. So why am I going to celebrate that kind of person? Because she's basically just a figurehead for this system. And if we actually put up a challenge to this system, people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg would have been an enemy to us. Workers would put up a challenge to it. She would have been opposed to that. She would have been against us. And all this talk of her being for women's rights would have gone out the window. So that's my opening thoughts.
I think for me, I will be honest, I did go through, do you know those, the stages, what are they called?
Of grief. Like,
the stages of grief? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I forget the order of the stages, but
yeah,
I went through like denial and then anger and sort of, I think I bought into the idea that the sort of savior complex that I put onto her subconsciously or somewhere there, maybe conscious, I don't know. However, it was in my psyche. I did hope, okay, she could last. Maybe also because I have a liberal background, meaning I had a very strong faith in the Democrats a long time ago, so I'm maybe still in the recovery stage of trying to not see her that way. Who knows? But I did feel a bit shocked, as if, oh my God. But I also knew it was coming. I just had hoped it wasn't during this term. And so I had some revelations over the past few days. And I'm glad that I kind of went through a process and I was writing down some things. And I think I'll just read a tweet from Jones Stucker, a writer at the Defense Post, that really, I follow on Instagram something called a user, a handle, however you call it, Comrade Broccoli. And they posted this tweet from Joan Stocker, and it's a system that cannot bear the loss of an 87-year-old woman because she is the bulwark of the rights of 330 million people, and that relies on the morals of four senators to prevent a 78-year-old man from rushing through her replacement is a system that is fundamentally broken. There is an issue with us, if we are investing or we put all of our eggs into one basket, if we have hopes for just one person and we're holding on to this very thin string of hope that we will be saved, and we put all of that onto one person, that takes away our power as a collective, as workers, as people. And that is largely due to, I was realizing, to the way that we are persuaded or tricked by the Democrats to trust them. And we then have now put all of our investments and energies, like we have all of this faith into one person to hold what we think will be justice for us all. There is just, there's an issue with that. I became impressed by the Republicans' way of wielding power, and almost had, this is terrible, but almost had some respect for them, for how they just do not care about maintaining rules, order, decorum, traditions, norms, or any sort of protocol. They don't care. Out with that. And even when Democrats tried to use someone that was more so-called moderate as Joe Biden as the nominee, they still call him a socialist just because they were picking him as a safer choice, according to liberals. And they still were able to, they still call Kamala Harris and Joe Biden socialists. They're just so relentless and so strong-willed. And I feel guilty just saying how impressed I am by them. And I realized then that there is just, the Democrats are the weakest party. I have no respect for them. And this is why I have begun to think that, just like in the time of the Bolsheviks, in what was it, Andy, 1917, was it? When they would fill in the seats with socialists, just completely overtaking and making demands. I think if we used only to use, not to have faith in the system, but we used folks, socialists who and anarchists who would go in and step into those seats to simply cause havoc, to simply take over governance, I would like to see someone with a strong-willed character that way. And currently, the Democrats have showed the most feeble, weakest part. They're the most weakest party I have ever seen. And there is no such thing anymore after this, for me at least, that there is a way to bring back some sort of understanding or norms or normalcy in this. And so I really do hope that we either have a revolution or we have people instigating, coming in with demands and not moving. And if Trump gets loses, I have a strong feeling he won't leave office. And that is, again, another way that people have, he has a very strong will, personality, and a party. And I've just lost respect for Democrats, and they're not our hope or our savior.
I mean, you mentioned how normalcy and coming back, you know, and, you know, like, I have questions about that. Was there anything ever normal? And the other thing that keeps coming back is, like, people talk about a broken system. The system is not broken. It's doing what it's supposed to do very efficiently.
Yeah.
You know, and then, like, to your point about the Republicans and the Democrats, I'm not so sure the Democrats are the weakest. You know, depending on what you measure, you know, for example, fooling you to think that they care about inclusivity and shit like that, you know, just to get you to vote. But in reality, they don't. Just as long as it serves them, you know, they'll keep using that. But they don't, they care about putting a label on you or talking of inclusivity, but, you know, sentencing you to poverty and struggling and being sick, you know, and being, you know, persecuted. So I don't think they're the weakest, because they are fooling a lot of people. And again, going back to Ginsburg, this is again that. You know, the liberal media is full on. You know, people that were against cops are now talking about Ginsburg. Did you see that you know, the lack of, you know, congruency or whatever the word is? You know, like, there's no logic there. If you're against cops, you cannot be pro-judges. You know, like, in so many people that were against cops, you know, abolish the police, all these sound bites, fell in line right away. Some people are coming back right now. But there, you know, a lot of people, it's like, okay, like, you know, I'm disillusioned, you know, but I'm still going to wait for you to do something. It's like an abusive relationship. I'm looking for that one little thing, you know, so that I can like come back to you. And so Ginsberg dies, and now it's like, oh, now I have something to fight for besides, you know, next to this, you know, horrible party. You know, never mind Kamala Harris, Biden, you know, their track record, their, you know, and the fact that the Democrats are perhaps more efficient, you know, in pro-business policies and stuff. And we keep assuming that they're pro-working class. They're not. You know, like one thing that gets overlooked too that I found out today is that a lot of the judges that Trump has appointed to the federal seats, the Democrats have not fought back at all.
Also lifetime appointments.
Also lifetime appointments. You know, like you were saying, it's the judicial monarchy. You know, they're lower rank, but they're part of that same system. And so where is the outrage that? So it, that's evidence that this is only being mobilized to get people into the ballot box. To keep fooling you that there is something there. That's how I see it.
Yeah. Eduardo, I think your points really have got me thinking. And they've in some ways got me thinking about the ISO, the International Socialist Organization, the organization I used to be in. Because those things that you ascribe to the Republican Party, like they just don't care. They will uproot anything. They will rip anything apart they need to for power. I do agree with that. Those features describe the U.S. capitalist class. They are willing to destroy the cradle of humanity and eradicate it, right? The area of Mesopotamia, and just dismantle it at a whim. They're uprooting right now education. They're willing to put people into lockdown no matter what. And they're willing to put as many people in jail as they have to in order to get as much wealth as they possibly can. So that is the nature of our capitalist class. So I do agree that that describes the capitalist class. But the capitalist class has two parties. And the socialist organization I was in used to say this about the Democratic Party. They're the second most, they would call them the second most enthusiastic capitalist party. And that was completely wrong. They are just as enthusiastic about capitalism as the Republican Party. They have a different way and a different strategy for how to rule over workers and how to expand the imperial reach. And let's remember that the experts of doing global war have been the Democrats. Whether it's Vietnam, whether it's World War II, whether it's Obama going in and extending two wars into seven. The experts at building a mass police state, all right, have been Bill Clinton and Joe Biden with the stuff they did over the three strikes laws and the experts at creating a dividing in wealth again have been Democratic Party, which grew immensely under Bill Clinton and extended over Barack Obama. So we have two extremely enthusiastic parties who will do anything they have to. They are both, I think they are both parties of complete immorality as it relates to humanity, as it relates to anything that we think of as in terms of good. They will use representation, right? They'll use, oh, we're gonna put a black person here. We're gonna put a woman here. But you can see now, we're about to get another woman Supreme Court justice coming right down. You can see what good that's going to do us, right? With this person who's I don't know what her name is. I mean,
Amy Barrett.
Amy Coney Barrett, right? So look, representation doesn't do anything other than you either put a female face or a lesbian face or a black face or a Latino face to your oppressor. Oh, that's the only thing it does. And it basically justifies it and tries to say that somehow this isn't sexism. This system isn't sexist. The system isn't racist, when it is thoroughly so. And these people who use representation and who have benefited off representation actually do as much, if not more, damage to the fight because they hide it. They try to put cosmetics over this evil thing, and they get rich and they get famous doing it. And they do it in the name of the movement they used to be part of, while that movement is destroyed and brought into the Democratic Party. So people like John Lewis, who was a civil rights activist, or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, these are not icons of the cause. We would call these people traitors to the cause because they essentially sold out their system so that they could benefit in the name of putting lipstick on the most barbaric country in the world, who will use this country will use its so-called progressivism around women to go and say, well, now we're progressive around women, so we're going to dismantle Afghanistan, we're going to dismantle Iraq, and use the cause of women to do that. And so people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg are essentially a justification for that kind of stuff. So I just want to say that I think the Democratic Party is very strong. Their weakness comes in the fact that their strategy is to lie to workers so that they can appeal to that base. That's their strategy. That's their appeal to the capitalist class. We will get workers to believe in your cause and we will sell your shit to them. So we have to learn how to lie to them. And so that's what makes them seem so weak. But they're after extremely capable, extremely crafty, extremely good at what they do, at holding power, at wielding power, and getting workers to suck it up and vote for them each time. How many times have we been at the most important election of our lifetimes? I'm 54. This is round 9 for me or something, just being the most important election of my lifetime, and for the Supreme Court to be in the hold, and for fascism to be on the rise, all that, everything, that gets said every election season, all right? And it's getting said again, and the Democrats are doing it again when they keep on betraying people and they keep on getting away with it. So that's an extremely powerful party that can do something like that. So I just would say that this notion that they're weak, I wish that was the case. I really do, because it would make the cause of revolution, of fighting back, easier. But we have two very powerful, very crafty parties fooling both sections of the working, right and left sections of the working class, into believing that somehow something's going to come from one of them.
I see the Republicans and Democrats as both capitalist class. I don't think that one is... personally, I disagree. I just respectfully disagree. I do think that the Republicans are more ruthless than the Democrats. The Republicans stonewall. The Republicans have more gerrymandering in this country. And in the last 7 elections, the Republicans have only won once by the popular vote. The Republicans have largely won through the Electoral College. So there are all these strategies that the Republicans use to be in power. And they're both very powerful capitalist parties, but I do think that the strategies that the Republicans use are very, if there is a circle of how they battle, they're willing to be in a fight breaking the rules more than the Democrats are, in general. I'm not talking about individuals. I'm talking in general. That is my point of view. And that's the way I see it. In my opinion, that's the way I see it. And I think that, especially on the left, I think we need to stop those of us who vote or progressives or even Democrats currently. Anyone that is on the left needs to stop putting faith in the Democrats. This is why I'm not voting for Joe Biden. I do not think that the Democrats are going to fight for me or do anything. And the way you said about they have not fought, who said, Kenny or Andy said that they did not fight for any of the lifetime appointees. I see that as just, again, they're being suckers and they're being weak. And they're again letting the Republicans rule over them. This is more of my thinking about how I'm thinking, how more evidence as to how, in my eyes, they're the weakest party. And I'm not going to vote Republican and I'm not going to vote Democrat. I really am looking forward to a representative that with strong principles, someone that I could look forward to vote for that is going to cause havoc, cause chaos, and do something that's completely out of the norm, completely out of tradition, and just ambush wherever office they are placed in, wherever they're voted in. That is my hope. So It's fine. I mean, I could see why you both would say that. Strategically, I do think the Democrats are just the weaker one of the two parties. There's no doubt that together they will defeat any third parties, or together they will come together to defeat socialism from rising, or together they will figure out a way just to expand their imperialism abroad. I do agree that that is true. But when it comes to domestic rights and sort of the Democrats give us so little, and then even that little bit of it, of what they give us, the Republicans still strategically are able to just break ruthlessly away from any sort of rule fighting, or they just completely strategically just outwin, I think, in the Democrats. And more of the reason why I just will not vote Democrat. I'll stop there. So if you want to comment on that.
Yeah. So the comment, you know, you said that you see them as weak, you know, like in the appointing of federal judges, lifetime appointments. To me, it's not even useful to think, like, in my opinion, that as they're weak or strong, you know, that's evidence to me that they're in the same game, you know, that they're pushing the same way, and they're just doing it in a different way. And we won't, you know, even if there is that one messianic figure, you know, that we hope for, because it's not new, you know, Obama, Bernie Sanders, Ocasio-Cortez, you know, name it, you know, and we have to understand that we're fighting a structure, you know, an organism. It's not one person. One person will never make a dent. And the solutions are not individual, they're collective. And, you know, they will have to come from the bottom. And again, losing faith in this system to me is very, losing faith while gaining confidence in your own, you know, in your own power. You know, that's somewhere there is where the solutions to get out of this horrible future that's coming is, you know, or at least to have a response to that. But I've like stopped thinking about, you know, this binary, like one or the other, or like what these minimalists think. Because even if those little things, when you really examine those little things that we supposedly get as crumbs, the cost or whatever's behind it, it's way more. Like whenever you get something, ask like, what did you give up? And then you'll find that you actually lost a lot more than you think you gained.
It's interesting how you both see it that way. I would almost think that in order for current Democrats or independents or possible Democrat votees, in order to appeal to them to peel away from the binary system, they would have to see how weak and incompetent and how they, the Democrats, really are, that they're not your savior, that they just should not be the people you should be voting for or have your confidence in or your faith in. I would think that that's what I think I'm trying to share with our audience. But it's interesting how you both think about it. It's just, I hope that the audience understands. I think my hope is that by sharing what I went through these past couple of days, that especially liberals and progressives that, you know, share posts, you know, lauding and praising RBG, sort of understand that that's my hope. And at least I'm sharing my experience, as I also felt some form of denial and sort of about of depression that, oh my gosh, you know, conservatives are going to take over the Justice Supreme Court. That my hope is that they understand that you need to peel away from your hopes into the Democrats. But I guess that's not, I don't know, it's just different how you two see it. And yeah, I'll just leave it at that. Yeah, I'm just sharing from what you said, yeah. Kenny, now, and I'm responding to it. So, and yeah, what you've also sort of aligned with Kenny then.
And just to say, it's actually, I think it ultimately becomes, I think it's an important point that the I believe the reason that our reason I'm doing what's left today and I'm not in the ISO is partially because my organization, and I think much of the revolutionary left, has underestimated the strength of the Democratic Party, have often accused them of being weak, and this is why they've sunk into them ultimately, thinking that they're going to trick them, thinking that they're going to go into them and peel off a section of their base. No one would ever think, no socialist would ever think you'd do that in the Republican Party. And they should equally understand there's no possibility of doing that Democratic Party. One, the party is too strong and too big in terms of its apparatus. I don't mean in terms of the actual, it doesn't have much of a membership base, but in terms of its the trade union apparatus, the NGOs, all these structures, they're immense compared to the size of us revolutionary leftists. And we always underestimate the game that they're playing, the game that the capitalists are playing, and particularly, I think, the Democratic Party. So I do feel like one of the reasons the ISO doesn't exist today is it's now essentially its members are in the Democratic Party through the DSA. And that largely came from misunderstanding, I believe. And this is only one of the only reasons why I'm making this point, extending it, is to say that ultimately we have to understand the seriousness and the strength and the wits of these two capitalist parties, that they are very strong, very smart. They know what they're doing, and we have to know what we're doing. We will not be able to infiltrate them, peel anything off from them. They will smash us into smithereens if we try doing that because of their strength. And we have to build our strength in another way. And I think that's one of the things that's also happened to revolutionaries is we haven't built a base within the class, among workers, among fellow workers. And we keep thinking that we can go into this electoral arena and build a stronger base. And it's like cotton candy. It disappears the minute it has contact with your mouth. And so we never build anything. I'm speaking to the revolutionary left and what I've seen of them. So rather than thinking, it's not just about they won't represent me, they are your implacable enemy. And when they come to tell you they're going to take guns from you, you have to understand you have to stop them. And when they come to say, we're going to keep you safe in your house, you have to understand, no way, you're not keeping me safe. You are my enemy. And the left is mistaken that. They think Gavin Newsom is trying to keep us safe or trying to do something for safety, and they're not. They are smashing us right now. They are destroying the working class and its ability to fight back. And that attack is being leveled by the Democratic Party on our thing. So it's much worse than they're not going to fight for us. It's not even about that. They are coming for our heads, and they've collected all our scalps, and they've got them there on display. So it's a wrap. Like I'm not saying they're not going to defend us. I'm saying we have to understand that we are in a life and death war, not just with the Republican Party, but with the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party is already inside of our house with their knife because we've let them in. And we think that they don't know what they're doing with their knife, but they definitely do know what they're doing with their knife. They know how to use it. They've been using it for decades. They used it against slaves back in the day in the Civil War. They used it against workers throughout this century. And FDR was no friend of the working person. They used it to essentially build their empire over World War II, which most people think was about fighting fascism, and it wasn't. It was about expanding U.S. imperial reach, and the right position would have been to defeat the U.S. in that war and try to take it down from inside, but very few socialists saw that, and today people think FDR is like our friend. He's not. He is our implacable enemy. As much as Mitt Romney, as much as Donald Trump, FDR is our complete enemy. If you're afraid of Donald Trump, you should be afraid of FDR. And that's the understanding that the left has not been able to embrace. And that's the reason I think they've been weak. The revolutionary left has been weak.
Oh, can you answer?
No, I mean, yeah, just like that's what I consider, you know, the reformist route, you know, like that we think that we can change this from the inside. And this brings to mind, you know, people like, again, messianic figures like Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez. that, you know, they have a function in this system, and it is to keep you in the system, keep you from straying outside the Democratic Party, from fully letting go. And so, yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, we have to see them both as, you know, enemies, and we have to question. Like, it takes more work to question what the Democrats are doing than the Republicans. Because, like you said, the Republicans basically are upfront about it. You know, we're gonna murder you. You're, you know, fucking racist openly. But the Democrats keep telling us again they're our friends while sticking the knife on the back every time. You know, or, you know, not pushing it all the way in to make you think that they're your friends. But no, I agree. You know, and that's what I mean by letting go. It's not enough to just say I'm not going to vote this time around. It's just to understand what the function of you know, doing that is, and then what our response is. And, you know, and yeah, there is no future at all in the Democrats. And just to kind of bring it back to Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders, this is why it was a revelation for me to kind of understand, you know, what they represent. You know, at one point, if you were, I guess, someone on the liberal left, the far left, like, maybe if they had left the party, you know, they have a lot of support, you know, that would have been a lot more radical than what they're doing right now. And so that goes to show you that they're in it to hold you in the party, because they're not really about fighting the establishment, you know, and brings it back to, like, Ginsburg. And, you know, they're about themselves ultimately, because, you know, they're all right.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the discussion. I think both of you give me insight into how maybe revolutionary socialists see and frame the current events, specifically to what happened with RBG. I hope that folks on the left don't try to work on the inside like so-called socialist, democratic socialist Bernie Sanders. I guess what I experience is sort of more evidence to the reasons why I don't trust in this party, the Democratic Party, who I have voted for in the past for seats in office. And I hope that, because it's hard not, especially amongst my community, for people to know that I'm not voting for Joe Biden, and people really criticize it as if I'm helping Trump win, you know. And then this is more evidence as to why I simply don't want to vote for the Democratic Party. And at least for me, it helps me understand that this is not going to go anywhere. It's not going to take me anywhere. It's the faith that I have in at least some people, such as AOC or Bernie Sanders. Those aren't people that are really going to stick their neck out for me if they're just conceding to the Democratic Party. And I don't believe that you can go in and infiltrate and try to work things, rearrange things inside. I really do think that we should. Workers should be occupying those seats and calling for a strike, and making unions stronger, and having unions go out on strike in solidarity. And I do believe that is the route for a revolution. I don't know when that will come, as I have repeated before, but I do think that we have to look for more radical folks from our people, that are workers, that aren't groomed politicians and groomed folks in schools and institutions. And that is only by what has transpired recently, has only been greatly enforced by the death of RBG. So I guess we may have a similar, I guess the only area where we have a similarity is just that the three of us are anti-capitalists and we see things differently, but I came about it up the mountain a different way than both of you.
I mean, this moves into a different area, but for some reason I am thinking about it. I want to say that the situation now for revolutionary socialists and revolutionary socialism, the prospects for it, which have, when you think about the Communist Party back in the 30s, which was massive, or even the socialist parties that have existed, and the Maoist and socialist parties that built themselves through the 60s and 70s, those are decimated. They're literally gone. And the Democratic Party can claim the scalps of those movements. They can say, we took them down, right? So the Democratic Party did their work. They took working class organizations whose prospects were for revolution, and they wrung them like a rag and chewed them up and spit them out, right? So the Democratic Party did that. Good for them. They know how to do that kind of stuff. And now we have a revolutionary movement which is in pieces and tatters. And there are some revolutionaries who do see that, who think that the way to try to build out of this situation is to get into the electoral arena. I'm not going to be a Democrat. I'm not going to be a Republican. I'm going to do it independently, but we can reach an audience of socialist politics. And I wish we were in a position to do that right now. My own feeling, and this is just me speaking, is we are at a position where we can do study groups. We can try to find socialists that we know and try to build study groups with them and figure out how do we put our politics in practice right now.
I feel you said the Bolsheviks too. And if we look in history, you said this in the past in another episode, Andy.
Yeah.
That's why I'm just trying to remind you of what you said before. But also, I mean, I'm reading this great book right now, and how even some anarchists took over some seats in the Spanish Revolution and during the Civil War.
Yeah.
And that happened in Russia. It happened in Spain, more so anarchism.
Yeah.
And if you do not just infiltrate if you don't just infiltrate one of the two most greatest, or even a third, if depending on which country, most strongest parties, but you take over the entire thing to cause havoc, not because you believe or you have faith in the system, but to try to really have workers demand the impossible and call for strikes to topple the current system. That is, I guess, the only usage that they can have to elect people in, to not really play with them, but to play as ruthlessly and more outside the line and become way more than an outlier and really do something that's really unprecedented, really like the word unprecedented, that is completely out there. I think that is what I guess I'm looking at from history. And that's what I suppose I'm taking my position from, or my way, my viewpoint from.
Yeah, and those are real things that those things happened, and revolutionaries in Spain and in Russia operated within the electoral system arena, tried to do so in a radical way. But they were also fairly strong and sizable parties at that time. They had a real significant numeric membership from which they could then organize things. That is not the situation we are in. We are atomized. And I feel like right now we're at a rebuilding operation. And the thing I'm inviting revolutionaries to do is very difficult, because I'm trying to do it and I find it very hard. It's very isolating. But I think trying to do an end run around our isolation by thinking we can, like, maybe I could run, or I could run for office and try to like get a hearing. It's like Icarus flying too close to the sun. Your wings melt and you come back to the ground and nothing is gained. And that's all I'm saying, is that our situation is so dire because of the Democratic Party and because of the way the revolutionary left has not dealt well, is that we are, I believe, at a completely start over operation, where we're literally trying to form small groups of comrades together to figure out how to understand theory and its relationship to practice at this moment. And to try to think that we can run candidates, even independent candidates right now, I think is a fantasy, to think we can build our operation that way. Right now, I think it's like we're just trying to find a few ground troops around us. And we're talking ones, twos, and threes in any given workplace. That's my feeling. And Kenny's had some experience trying to do this, but I'm just speaking. And it's not a fun situation. It mostly feels like failure. But frankly, I don't see a way around it.
Yeah. I mean, like, at least in my circles, what I'm trying to do is kind of push a different set of questions, because I don't even think we're asking the right questions. because you know, there is this this thing in front of the National Stadium in Chile where they, you know, they murder a lot of people when Pinochet came into power. And it stands today and it says, un pueblo sin memoria es un pueblo sin futuro. So people without a memory are people with no future. And I think that's what I'm trying to do, try to rescue that memory of working class struggle, you know, and build from there, you know, because ultimately we are going to have to build our own, we have our own tools. We're going to have to figure out our own way. And so, yeah, I mean, we are very, 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 very beginnings, you know, and when people are afraid to even read Marx, you know, just to, just for the heck of it, that's very troubling. You know, because, you know, you're attacking capitalism, but yet you never read this, like, wonderful analysis, you know, critique of this system that still stands, you know, and so, yeah, building blocks, I guess, and we're far, I'm not delusional, and things don't spring up just from nothing, you know, there has to be, like, a foundation, and, you know, gotta get some mud and, like, make foundations.
I mean, this doesn't have to be in the episode if you don't want, Kenny, but are you struggling?
Well, no, I've actually had some success, which actually comes to a surprise with Lipson, that there are people asking questions. I'm open about my politics. Some people disagree with me, but they engage. And, you know, I'm learning too. I'm learning to communicate my ideas without being condescending. Because, you know, I'm a recovery liberal after all. And so I am trying to ask more questions and genuinely learn. And I think that, you know, the answer is not in, like, the Republican Democrats, you know, one or the other, this binary. I think that we need to, like, on liberal side, we need to listen to, you know, conservatives and find a commonality in the same way, you know, like, I'm not concerned about those radicals that would never change their mind on the right wing. You know, I'm concerned, you know, because we're going to have to fight them anyway. And so I'm concerned about the people that don't have political space on the left right now. You know, that there is no, you know, no room for them to express their disgust or their anxieties. In that I think they're rooted in the same thing, obviously. And so I'm trying to kind of play a bridge as a revolutionary between that so that we can start maybe even having more conversations and realize that, you know, we have more to gain from struggling together. So, but yeah, but I think, yeah, I don't feel disillusioned so much. I know we're far because some, you know, the progress is very minimal. Like, and who knows? I'm fucking wrong. I might be wrong. You know, I'm open to that idea, but, like, let's use some logic, not gut feelings, not personality politics. You know, let's have some discussions about this.
And maybe this is actually a segue to what potentially would be our next week's episode. We'll see. But I think this issue about the what's happening with the Supreme Court is not just going to come up as it relates to the candidates of the election, but it's going to feature in the process of the election. Because this election process looks to be quite a show that's coming this year. And I feel like it's literally a predicted crisis coming, an electoral crisis, like we had in the year 2000 when there was hanging chads and the Supreme Court had to decide that thing. The Supreme Court is going to figure into the decision of who our president is in 2020. So that's where all this stuff is coming up. That's why all this stuff is coming up like this. And we thought the Electoral College was small for deciding who the president is. Now we have 9 monarchical justices going to be deciding who the president is. Lifetime appointees.
I should mention, I did say this in another episode that we did on Brett Kavanaugh, that I don't understand how this country has a lifetime appointees and 9 justices here in the USA, and in Mexico we have 11 and they're only up to 15 years. They're not lifetime appointees. Not that I know that you both would say that neither system is worth even talking about, but to me as a Mexican and looking at this and knowing Mexican politics, for me, it's a lot different than the way that I see this. It's just strange how this lifetime appointee is just off. You know, in Mexico, we just don't have lifetime appointees like that. All right. Where do we go from here?
We at least have to acknowledge that Randy and I are now engaged.
Yes. Right. Oops.
That was the most important event that happened. All this other stuff we've been talking about, not important. Randy and I getting engaged. I finally offered her a ring and asked for her hand in marriage, and she said yes.
Andy, okay. Congratulations, Andy.
And if she allows me, I'll post a picture of the ring on this episode, but I have to get her permission.
And RBG wanted to ruin your proposal.
I know, she's trying to steal my... See, she's so selfish.
Jesus. I'm not participating. Carrying on.
That's what liberals would say. By not participating, you're supporting. So thank you for your support.
No, I understand it. But I wanted to make sure I at least acknowledge this important well, other event.
I look forward, Andy, to some celebratory ceremony that is safe, that is...
You're touching a sore spot here, Eduardo. I'm like, I've already said I don't want a wedding with masks.
Yeah. It's
oh, God. Oh, God.
It's going to be
massive. Right? I should not get into this. We're enjoying our engagement right now, and we're going to try to figure out how to have a celebration that makes everyone happy. I don't know if we can do it, but we're going to try to do that. But she and I have to be happy first.
Yes, that's true. That's very true, Andy. Otherwise, you're going to show up to a wedding and you might be the only one there.
I do want you there, Eduardo, of course. I have to figure out how to get you there.
Kenny was going to say something. I interrupted, sorry.
No. I can draw circles on your backyard.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
I'll have Kenny draw circles, and we'll put your name in one of the circles, Eduardo. You can just stay there the whole time.
You know, we'll do hearts instead of circles.
Oh, yeah, that would be better. Hearts. Kenny, you're going to be my wedding planner, apparently.
Yeah, I planned my brother's wedding like I did. You know, I can just copy and paste.
Little hearts 6 feet from each other all over the place. Yeah. It just sounds beautiful. It sounds magical.
But then again, I don't want to fight with Hema. I'm sure you want to do this.
It's true.
Yeah.
But hearts is a very good idea. So if no one comes up with that, Andy, you should do that. If you do any sort of parameter.
Oh, gosh. That's so hard. Honestly, that triggers me just to think about it, because I just want to have people together. So anyway, we'll see. We'll figure it out. But I'm very happy. And Brandy, once she got over the surprise, now I think she's happy too. It took like 24 hours for her to start to feel happy that she was engaged.
did it register, or did she first ask, "Are we doing a ceremony?"
No. She really was surprised in the proposal. She knew I wanted to marry, but she didn't see it coming. She thought the COVID thing was overwhelming everything. We just have to wait and wait and wait. And I was like, yeah, I don't want to wait.
Wait, didn't you have kind of a plan yourself, like a time frame as to how long you wanted to go and then propose?
You mean propose before the wedding?
Yeah. Or like, okay.
No, I didn't. Mostly once I felt in February after I'd had my medical thing and Brandy was so central in getting me through that, it was like, okay, we just got to get married.
You're like, you need a nurse.
Right. Nurse Brandy. She did all sorts of medical things on my back and, you know, removes blood from my ear when I had, you know, so she has done all sorts of things. So I think once I knew I wanted to get married, I just wanted to get moving. And the shutdown kind of slowed things down a little bit, but finally, you know, it's official. So I'm excited.
Congrats.
Thank you.
All right, shall we?
Yeah.
That does it for this week's episode. What's Left is a weekly political podcast that's challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes, wherever you found this episode, or on our blog at what-s-left.webnode.com. And you can find past episodes to this podcast/channel there and connect with us. I remind folks that if you like anything that you have heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, turn on your notifications, and subscribe to any of our 6 platforms on Spotify, iTunes Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-host Kenny Cepeda and Andy Lipson. Take care and congratulations, Andy.
Again. Thank you.
Yep.
All right. Bye-bye.